Roots listener-funded radio station. Tune in on Saturday, September 11th from 4 to 6 p.m. for a live listener forum. It features candidates for WBAI's local station board. If you're wondering what skills and contribution these candidates plan to bring to WBAI as board members, well, they'll have some answers for you, and you'll have a chance to ask the candidates some questions of your own. Tune in to the live listener forum from 4 to 6 p.m. on Saturday, September 11th, right here on WBAI New York.
Good morning, everybody. It is indeed September 11th, a Saturday. Up next, we have the Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund, followed by Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. I know that David will have a segment on the Attica situation way back when, in the 70s. We have a special at 11, a Dream Leaper special on 9/11, and that will be coming up at 11 o'clock. Noon, advocating for justice, and then talk out of school. This is WBAI New York, listener-supported radio in New York City. Here comes Jim Freund and Hour of the Wolf.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a reading that we like to play pretty much annually, especially today on the 20th anniversary of the Fall of the Towers, September 11th. There's a Hole in the City. Read by the author, Richard Bowes. Stay tuned. and good morning. Due to the nature of this morning's program, we don't have time for Dan Person's usual review, so we're going to put that off till next week. But in 2005, 5 years after the fall of the towers on September 11th, Rick Bowes, who's been a regular contributor to this program and an all-time favorite guest, wrote a story for Sci Fiction magazine, edited by Ellen Datlow, entitled There's a Hole in the City. And it has, for me and many other people, been one of the most important works of fiction regarding not just September 11th, but the aftermath of September 11th, and, as you will hear, other huge disasters that have occurred through history in New York City. We'll talk a little bit more about that after the reading, but first let me tell you a bit about Rick. Richard Bowes has published 6 novels, 4 short story collections, and over 70 short stories. He has won 2 World Fantasy, a Lambda, Million Writer, and International Horror Guild Awards. His novel Dust Devil on a Quiet Street was on the 2014 World Fantasy and Lambda shortlists. By the way, if you would like to read this story in print, you can do so at nightmaremagazine.com. Rick is perhaps one of my favorite all-time guests. Whenever there has been a major change to this program, change in time slot, change in whatever, Rick has usually been the first guest and occasionally the last guest that I've had on the air. Not in the case this year when I moved to 7 a.m. for various reasons, but that will not change this morning's broadcast, which is perhaps one of the most important things that he has ever done for WBAI and for Hour of the Wolf. That will not stop us from rebroadcasting this story. We were able to broadcast it on the 10th anniversary of February 11th, thanks to time put aside by our then program director, Tony Bates, and station manager, still station manager, Berthold Reimers. And here we are, 10 years later, to hear it again. So, without further ado, let me present Richard Bowes.
There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes. Wednesday, 9:12:01. On the evening of the day after the towers fell, I was waiting by the barricades on Houston Street and LaGuardia Place for my friend Mags to come up from Soho and have dinner with me. On the skyline, not 2 miles to the south, the pillars of smoke wavered slightly, but the creepily beautiful weather of September 11th still held, and the wind blew in from the northeast. In Greenwich Village, the air was crisp and clean, with just a touch of fall about it. I'd spent the last day and a half looking at pictures of burning towers. One of the frustrations of that time was that there was so little most of us could do anything about anything or for anyone. Downtown streets were empty of all traffic except emergency vehicles. The West and East Villages, from 14th Street to Houston, were their own separate zone. Pedestrians needed identification, proving they lived or worked there, in order to enter. The barricades consisted of blue wooden police horses and a couple of unmarked vans thrown across LaGuardia Place. Behind them were a couple of cops, a few auxiliary police, and one or two guys in civilian clothes with IDs of some kind pinned to their shirts. All of them looked tired, subdued by events. At the barricades was a small crowd, ones like me waiting for friends from neighborhoods to the south, ones without proper identification, waiting for confirmation so they could continue on into Soho. People who just wanted to be outside near other people in those days of sunshine and shock. Once in a while, each of us would look up at the columns of smoke that hung in the downtown sky, then look away again. A family approached, a middle-aged cop behind the barricades. The group consisted of a man, a woman, a little girl being led by the hand, a child being carried. All were blondish and wore shorts and casual tops. The parents seemed pleasant but serious people in their early 30s, professionals. They could have been tourists, but that day the city was empty of tourists. The man said something, and I heard the cop say loudly, "You want to go where?" "Down there," the man gestured at the columns. He indicated the children. "We want them to see." It sounded as if he couldn't imagine this appeal not working. Everyone stared at the family. "No ID, no passage," said the cop, and turned his back on them. The pleasant expressions on the parents' face faded. They looked indignant, like a maitre d' had lost their reservations. She led one kid, he carried another, as they turned west, probably headed for another checkpoint. "They wanted those little kids to see Ground Zero?" a woman who knew the cop asked. "Are they out of their minds?" "Looters," he replied. "That's my guess." He picked up his walkie-talkie to call the checkpoints ahead of them. Mags appeared just then, looking a bit frayed. When you've known someone for as long as I've known her, the tendency is not to see the changes, to think you both look about the same as when you were kids. But kids don't have gray hair, and their bodies aren't thick the way bodies get in their late 50s. Their kisses aren't perfunctory. Their conversation doesn't include curt little nods that indicate something is understood. We walked in the middle of the streets because we could. "Couldn't sleep much last night," I said. "Because of the quiet," she said. "No planes. I kept listening for them. I haven't been sleeping anyway. I was supposed to be in housing court today, but the courts are shut until further notice." I said, "Notice how, with only the ones who live here allowed in, the South Village is all Italians and hippies. Like 1965 all over again." She and I had been in contact more in the past few months than we had in a while. Memories of love and indifference that we shared had made close friendship an on-and-off thing for the last 30-something years. Earlier in 2001, at the end of an affair, I'd surrendered a rent-stabilized apartment for a cash settlement and bought a tiny co-op in the South Village. Mags lived as she had for years in a run-down building on the fringes of Soho. So we saw each other again. I write, obviously, but she never read anything I published, which bothered me. On the other hand, she worked on and off for various activist leftist foundations, and I was mostly uninterested in that. Mags was in the midst of a classic New York work and housing trouble. Currently, she was on unemployment, and her landlord wanted to get her out of her apartment so he could co-op her building. The money offer he had made wasn't bad, but she wanted things to stay as they were. It struck me that what was youthful about her was that she had never settled into her life, still stood at the edge. Lots of the village restaurants weren't open. The owners couldn't or wouldn't come into the city. Angelina's on Thompson Street was, though, because Angelina lives just a couple of doors down from her place. She was busy serving tables herself, since the waiters couldn't get in from where they lived. Later, I had reason to try and remember. The place was full, but very quiet. People murmured to each other, as Mags and I did. Nobody I knew was there. In the background, Rasvigi's ancient airs and dances played. "Like the Blitz," someone said. "Never the same again," said a person at another table. "There isn't even any place to volunteer to help," a third person said. I don't drink anymore, but Mags, as I remember, had a carafe of wine. Phone service had been spotty, but we had managed to exchange bits of what we had seen. "Mrs. Pirelli," I said, "the Italian lady upstairs from me. I told you she had a heart attack watching the smoke and flames. On television, her son worked in the World Trade Center, and she was sure he had burned to death." Getting an ambulance wasn't possible yesterday morning, but the guys at the little fire barn around the corner were there waiting to be called, I guess. They took her to St. Vincent's in the chief's car. Right about then, her son came up the street, his pinstripe suit with a hole burned on the shoulder, soot on his face, wild-eyed, but alive. Today they say she's doing fine. I waited, spearing clams, twirling linguine. Mags had a deeper and darker story to tell, a dip into the subconscious. Before I'd known her and afterwards, Mags had a few rough brushes with mental disturbance. Back in college, where we first met, I envied her that, wished I had something as dramatic to talk about. I've been thinking about what happened last night. She'd already told me some of this. The downstairs bell rang, which scared me. But with phone service being bad, it could have been a friend, someone who needed to talk. I looked out the window. The street was empty, dead, like I'd never seen it. Nothing but papers blowing down the street. You know how, every time you see a scrap of paper now, you think it's from the Trade Center? For a minute, I thought I saw something move. But when I looked again, there was nothing. I didn't ring the buzzer, but it seemed someone upstairs did, because I heard this noise, a rustling in the hall. When I went to the door and lifted the spy hole, this figure stood there on the landing, looking around like she was lost. She wore a dress, long and torn, and a blouse, what I realized was a shirt waist, turn-of-the-century clothes. When she turned towards my door, I saw her face. It was bloody, smashed like she had taken a big jump or fall. I gasped, and then she was gone.
And you woke up?
No, I tried to call you. But the phones were all screwed up. She had fallen, but not from 100 stories. Anyway, she wasn't from here and now. Mags had emptied the carafe. I remember that she just had ordered a salad and didn't eat that. But Angelina brought a fresh carafe. I told Mags about the family at the barricades. There's a hole in the city, said Mags. That night, after we had parted, I lay in bed, watching but not seeing some old movie on TV, avoiding any channel with any kind of news. And the buzzer sounded. I jumped up and went to view the screen. On the empty streets downstairs, a man, wild-eyed, disheveled, glared directly into the camera. Phone service was not reliable. Cops were not in evidence in the neighborhood right then. I froze and didn't buzz him in. But, as in Mag's building, someone else did. I bolted my door, watched at the spy hole, listened to the footsteps, slow and uncertain. When he came into sight on the second-floor landing, he looked around and said in a hoarse voice, "Hello, sorry, but I can't find my mom's front door key." Only then did I unlock the door, open it, and ask her exhausted son how Mrs. Pirelli was doing. "Fine," he said, "getting great treatment. St. Vincent was geared up for thousands of casualties. Instead," he shrugged, "anyway, she thanks all of you. Me too." In fact, I hadn't done much. We said good night, and he shuffled on upstairs to where he was crashing in his mother's place. Thursday, 9:13. By September of 2001, I had worked an information desk in the university library for almost 30 years. I live right around the corner from Washington Square, and just before 10 a.m. on Thursday, I went out for work. The Muslim-run souvlaki stand across the street was still closed. Its owner and workers gone since Tuesday morning. All the little falafel shops in the South Village were shut and dark. On my way to work, I saw a three-legged rat running not too quickly down the middle of McDougal Street. I decided not to think about portents and symbolism. The big TV set up in the library atrium was still showing the towers falling again and again, but now they also showed workers digging in the flaming wreckage at Ground Zero. Like the day before, I was the only one in my department who had made it in. The librarians lived too far away. Even Marco, the student assistant, wasn't around. Marco lived in a dorm downtown right near the World Trade Center. Then had been evacuated with nothing more than a few books and the clothes they were wearing. Tuesday had been very upset. I'd given him Kleenex, made him take deep breaths, got him to call his mother back in California. I'd even walked him over to the gym where the university was putting up the displaced students. Tuesday morning, all of the computer stations around the information desk were occupied. Students sat furiously typing email and devouring incoming messages, but the intensity had slackened since 9/11. The girls no longer sniffed and dabbed at tears as they read. The boys didn't jump up and come back from the restrooms red-eyed and saying they had allergies. I said good morning and sat down. The kids hadn't spoken much to me in the last few days, had no questions to ask, but all of them from time to time would turn and look to make sure I was still there. If I got up to leave the desk, they'd ask when I was coming back. Some of the back windows had a downtown view. The pillar of smoke wavered. The wind was changing. The phone rang. Reception had improved. Most calls went through. When I answered, a voice, tight and tense, blurted out, Jenny Levine was who I saw. She was 19 years old in 1911 when the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory burned. She lived in my building with her family 90 years ago. Her spirit found its way home, but the inside of my building has changed so much that she didn't recognize it. "Hi, Mags," I said. "You want to come up here and have lunch?" A couple of hours later, we were in a small dining hall, normally used by faculty, on the west side of the square. The university, with food on hand and not enough people to eat it, had thrown opens at cafeterias and dining halls to anybody with a university identification. We could even bring a friend if we cared to. Now that I looked, Mags had tension lines around her eyes, and hair could have used some tending. But we were all of us a little ragged in those days of sun and horror. People kept glancing downtown, even if they were inside and not near a window. The Indian lady who ran the facility greeted us, thanked us for coming. I had a really nice gumbo, fresh avocado salad, a soothing pudding. The place was half empty, and conversations again were muted. I told Mags about Mrs. Pirelli's son the night before. She looked up from her plate, unsmiling, said, "I did not imagine Jenny Levine," and cleared that subject.
Take it from the Indian lady who ran the facility.
Okay.
Paragraph before.
The Indian lady who ran the facility greeted us, thanked us for coming. I had a really nice gumbo, French avocado salad, a soothing pudding. The place was half empty, and conversations again were muted. I told Mags about Mrs. Pirelli's son the night before. She looked up from her plate, unsmiling, said, "I did not imagine Jenny Levine," and closed that subject. Afterwards, she and I stood on Washington Place before the university building that had once housed the sweatshop called the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory. At the end of the block, a long convoy of olive green army trucks rolled silently down Broadway. Mag said, "On the afternoon of March 25, 1911, 146 young women burned to death on this site. Fire broke out in a pile of rags. The door to the roof was locked. The fire ladders couldn't reach the eighth floor. The girls burned." Her voice tightened as she said, "They jumped and were smashed on the sidewalk. Many of them, most of them, lived right around here, in the renovated tenements we live in now. It's like those planes blew a hole in the city, and Jenny Levine returned through it." "Easy, honey. The university has grief counseling available. I think I'm going. You want me to see if I can get you in?" It sounded idiotic even as I said it. We had walked back to the library. "There are others," she said. "Kids all blackened and bloated and wearing old-fashioned clothes. I woke up early this morning and couldn't go back to sleep. I got up and walked around here and over in the East Village." "Jesus," I said. "Jeffrey has come back, too. I know it. Mags, don't." This was something we hadn't talked about in a long time. Once there were three, and Jeffrey was the third. He was younger than either of us by a couple of years, at a time of life when that still seemed a major difference. We called him Lord Jeff because we said we were all a bit better than the world around us. We joked that he was our child, a little family cemented by desire and drugs.
Take it from "we called him Lord Jeff."
We called him Lord Jeff because he said we were all a bit better than the world around us. We joked that he was our child, a little family cemented by desire and drugs. The three of us were all so young, just out of school and in the city. Then jealousy and the hard realities of addiction began to tear us apart. Each had to find his or her own survival. Mags and I made it. As it turned out, Jeff wasn't built for the long haul. He was 21. We were all just kids, ignorant and reckless. As I made excuses in my mind, Mags gripped my arm. "He'll want to find us," she said. Chilled, I watched her walk away and wondered how long she had been coming apart and why I hadn't noticed. Back at work, Marco waited for me. He was part Filipino, bit of a little wise-ass who dressed in downtown black. But that was the week before. Today he was a woebegone refugee in oversized flip-flops, a magenta sweatshirt, and gym shorts, all of which had been made for someone bigger and more buff. "How's it going?" "It sucks. My stuff is all downtown where I don't know if I can ever get it. They have these crates in the gym, toothbrushes, bras, big razors, but never what you need. Everything from boxer shorts on out, and nothing is ever the right size. I gave my clothes in to be cleaned, and they didn't bring them back. Now I look like a clown. They have all of us sleeping on cots in the basketball courts. I lay there all last night staring up at the ceiling with 100 other guys. Some of them snore. One was yelling in his sleep. I don't want to take a shower with a bunch of guys staring at me. He told me all this while not looking my way, but I understood what he was asking. I expected this was going to be a pain, but given that I couldn't seem to do much for Mags, I thought maybe it would be a distraction to do what I could for someone else. Want to take a shower at my place? Crash on my couch? Could I, please? So I took a break, brought him around the corner to my apartment, put sheets on the daybed. He was in the shower when I went back to work. That evening when I got home, he woke up. When I went out to take a walk, he tagged along. We stood at the police barricades at Houston Street and 6th Avenue and watched the traffic coming up from the World Trade Center site. An ambulance with one side smashed and a squad car with its roof crushed were hauled up 6th Avenue on the back of a huge flatbed truck. NYPD buses were full of guys returning from Ground Zero, hollow-eyed, filthy. Crowds of Greenwich Villagers gathered on the sidewalks, clapped and cheered, yelled, "We love our firemen. We love our cops." The firehouse on 6th Avenue had taken a lot of casualties when the tower fell. The place was locked and empty. We looked at the flowers and the wreaths on the doors, the signs with faces of the firefighters who hadn't returned, and the messages to the brave men of these companies who gave their lives defending us. The plume of smoke downtown rolled in the twilight, buffeted about by shifting winds. The breeze brought with it, for the first time, the acrid smoke that would be with us for weeks afterwards. Officials said it was the stench of burning concrete. I believed, as did everyone else, that part of what we breathed was the ashes of the ones who had burned to death that Tuesday. It started to drizzle. Mark stuck close to me as we walked back. Hip 20-year-olds do not normally hang out with guys almost three times their age. This kid was very scared. Bleecker Street looked semi-abandoned.
Could you take it again from "it started to drizzle"?
It started to drizzle. Marco stuck close to me as we walked back. Hip 20-year-olds do not normally hang out with guys almost three times their age. This kid was very scared. Bleecker Street looked semi-abandoned, with lots of stores and restaurants still closed. The ones that were open were mostly empty at 9 in the evening. "If I buy you a six-pack, you promise to drink all of it?" He indicated he would. At home, Marco asked to use the phone. He called people he knew on campus looking for a spare dorm room and spoke in whispers to a girl named Eloise. In between calls, he worked the computer. I played a little Lady Day, some Ray Charles, a bit of Haydn, stared at the TV screen. The president had pulled out of his funk and was coming to New York the next day. In the next room, the phone rang. "No, my name's Marco," I heard him say. "He's letting me stay here." I knew who it was before he came in and whispered. She asked if I was Lord Jeff. "Hi, Mags," I said. She was calling from somewhere, with walkie-talkies and sirens in the background. "Those kids I saw and asked a place," she said, her voice clear and crazed, "the ones all burned and drowned? They were on the General Slocum when it caught fire." "The kids you saw and asked a place, all burned and drowned," I asked. Then I remembered our conversation earlier. "On June 15th, 1904, the biggest disaster in New York City history, until now, the East Village was once called Little Germany. Tens of thousands of Germans with their own meeting halls, churches, beer gardens. They had a Sunday excursion, mainly for the kids, on a steamship, the General Slocum, a floating fire trap. When it burst into flames, there were no lifeboats. The crew and the captain panicked. By the time they got to a dock, over 1,000 were dead, burned, drowned. When a hole got blown in the city, they came back looking for their homes." The connection started to dissolve into static. "Where are you, Mags?" "Ground Zero. It smells like burning sulfur. Have you seen Jeffrey yet?" she shouted into her phone. "Jeffrey is dead, Mags. It's all the horror and tension that's doing this to you. There's no hole. Cops and firemen and brokers, all smashed and charred, are walking around down here."
Take it from Jeffrey is dead.
"Jeffrey is dead, Mags. It's all the horror and tension that's doing this to you. There's no hole. Cops and firemen and brokers, all smashed and charred, are walking around down here." At that point, sirens screamed in the background. Men were yelling. The connection faded. "Mags, give me your number. Call me back," I yelled. Then there was nothing but static, followed by a weak dial tone. I hung up and waited for the phone to ring again. After a while, I realized Marco was standing looking at me, slugging down beer. She saw those kids? I saw them, too. Tuesday night, I was too jumpy to even lie down on the goddamn cot. I snuck out with my friend Terry. We walked around. The kids were there, in old historical clothes, covered with mud and seaweed, and their faces all black and gone. That's why I couldn't sleep last night. You talked to the counselors? I asked. He drained the bottle. Yeah, but they didn't want to hear what I wanted to talk about. But with me? You're crazy, you understand. The silence outside was broken by a jet engine. We both flinched. No planes had flown over Manhattan since the ones that had smashed into the towers on Tuesday morning. Then I realized what it was. The Air Force, I said, making sure it's safe for Mr. Bush's visit. Who's Mags? Who's Lord Jeff? So I told him a bit of what had gone on in that strange, lost country, the 1960s, the naivete that led to meth and junk. I described the wonder of that unknown land, the three-way union. Our problem, I guess, was that instead of a real menage, each member was obsessed with only one of the others. Okay, he said. You're alive. Mags is alive. What happened to Jeff? When things were breaking up, Jeff got caught in a drug sweep. He was being hauled downtown on the back of a police van. He cut his wrists and bled to death in the dark before anyone noticed. This did for me what speaking about the dead kids had maybe done for him. Each of us got talk about what bothered him without having to think about what the other said. Friday, 9:14. Friday morning, two queens walked by with their little dogs as Marco and I came out the door of my building. One said, "There isn't a fresh croissant in the entire village. It's like the siege of Paris. We'll all be reduced to eating rats." I murmured, "He's getting a little ahead of the story. Maybe first he should think about having an English muffin." "Or eating his yappy dog," said Marco. At that moment, the authorities opened the East and West villages between 14th and Houston Street to outside traffic. All these people whose cars had been stranded since Tuesday began to come into the neighborhood and drive them away. Delivery trucks started to appear on the narrow streets. In the library, the huge TV screens showed the activity at Ground Zero, the preparations for the president's visit. An elevator door opened and revealed a couple of refugee kids in their surplus gym clothes, clasped in a passion clinch. The computers around my information desk were still fully occupied, but the tension level had fallen. There was even a question or two about books and databases. I tried repeatedly to call Mags. All I got was the chilling message on her answering machine. In a staccato voice, it said, "This is Mags McConnell. There's a hole in the city, and I've turned this into a center for information about the victims Jenny Levine and Jeffrey Holborn. Anyone with information concerning the whereabouts of these two young people, please speak after the beep." I left a few messages asking her to call. Then I called every half hour or so, hoping she'd pick up. I phoned mutual friends. Some were absent or unavailable. A couple were nursing grief of their own. No one had seen her recently. That evening, in the growing dark, lights flickered in Washington Square. Candles were given out. Candles were lighted with matches and bics and wick to wick. Various priests, ministers, rabbis, and shamans led flower-bearing, candlelit congregations down the street and into the park, where they joined the gathering vigil crowd. Marco had come by with his friend Terry, a kind of elfin kid, but also had to stay at the gym. We went to this 9/11 vigil together. People addressed the crowd, gave impromptu elegies. There were prayers and a few songs. Then, by instinct or some plan I hadn't heard about, everybody started to move out of the park and flow in groups through the streets. We paused at street lamps that bore signs with pictures of pajama-clad families in suburban rec rooms on Christmas mornings. One face would be circled in red, and there would be a message like, "This is James Bolton, husband of Susan, father of Jimmy, Anna, and Sue, last seen leaving his home in Far Rockaway at 7:30 a.m. on 9/11. This was followed by the name of the company, the floor of the Trade Center tower where he worked, phone and fax numbers, the email address, and the words, "If you have any information about where he is, please contact us." At each sign, someone would leave a lighted candle on a tin plate. Someone else would leave flowers. The doors of the little neighborhood fire rescue station would open. The truck and the command car were gone. The place was manned by retired firefighters, with faces like old Irish and Italian character actors. A big picture of a fireman who had died was hung up beside the door. He was young, maybe 30. He and his wife, or maybe his girlfriend, smiled in front of a ski lodge. The picture was framed with children's drawings of firemen and fire trucks and fires, with condolences and novena cards. As we walked and the night progressed, the crowd got stretched out. We'd see clumps of candles ahead of us on the streets. It was Great Jones Street and the Bowery that suddenly were just the three of us and no traffic to speak of. When I turned to say maybe we should go home, I saw for a moment a tall guy staggering down the street with his face purple and his eyes bulging out. Then he was gone. Either Marco or Terry whispered, "Christ, he killed himself." And none of us said anything more. At some point in the evening, I had said Terry could spend the night in my apartment. He couldn't take his eyes off Marco, though Marco seemed not to notice. On our way home, way east on Bleecker Street, outside a bar that had been old even when I hung out there as a kid, I saw the poster. It was like a dozen others I'd seen that night, except it was in old-time black and white, and showed three kids with lots of hair and bad attitude, Mags and Jeffrey and me. Jeff's face was circled, and under it was written, "This is Jeffrey Holborn. If you have seen him since Tuesday, 9/11, please contact." And Mags had left her name and numbers. Even in the photo, I looked towards Jeffrey, who looked towards Mags, who looked towards me. I stared for just a moment before going on, but I knew that Marco had noticed. Saturday, 9:15. My tiny apartment was a crowded mess Saturday morning. Every towel I owned was wet. Every glass and mug was dirty. It smelled like a zoo. There were pizza crusts in the sink and a bag of beer cans at the front door. The night before, none of us had talked about ghosts. Marco and Terry had seriously discussed whether they would be drafted or would enlist. The idea of them in the army did not make me feel any safer. Saturday is a work day for me. Getting ready, I reminded myself that this would soon be over. The university had found all the refugee kids' dorm rooms on campus. Then the bell rang, and a young lady with a nose ring and bright red ringlets of hair appeared. Eloise was another refugee, though a much better organized one. She had brought bagels and my guest's laundry. Marcus seemed delighted to see her. That morning, all the restaurants and bars, the tattoo shops and massage parlors were opening up. Even the Arab falafel shop owners had risked insults and death threats to ride the subway in from Queens and open their doors for business. At the library, the huge screens in the lobby were being taken down. A couple of students were borrowing books. One or two even had in-depth reference questions for me. When I finally worked up the courage to call Mags, all I got was the same message as before. Marco appeared, dressed in his own clothes and clearly feeling better. He hugged me. "You were great to take me in. It helped me even more," I told him. He paused, then asked, "That was you in the poster last night, wasn't it? You and Mags and Jeffrey." The kid was a bit uncanny. When I nodded, he said, "Thanks for talking about that." I was in a hurry when I went off duty Saturday evening. A friend had called, invited me to an impromptu survivor's party. In the days of the French Revolution, the Terror, that's what they called the soirees, at which people danced and drank all night, then went out at dawn to see which of their names were on the list of those to be guillotined. On Sixth Avenue, a bakery that had very special cupcakes with devastating frosting was opening again. The avenue was clogged with honking, creeping traffic. A huge chunk of Lower Manhattan had been declared open that afternoon, and people were able to get the cars that had been stranded down there. The bakery was across the street from a Catholic church, and that afternoon in that place, a wedding was being held. As I came out with my cupcakes, the bride and groom, not real young, not very glamorous, but obviously happy, came out the door and posed on the steps for pictures. Traffic was at a standstill. People beeped. "Here comes the bride," leaned out their windows, applauded and cheered, all of us relieved to find this ordinary, normal thing taking place. Then I saw her on the other side of Sixth Avenue. Mags was tramping along, staring straight ahead, a poster with a black-and-white photo hanging from a string around her neck. The crowd in front of the church parted for her. Mourners were sacred at that moment. I yelled her name and started to cross the street, but the tie-up had eased. Traffic started to flow. I tried to keep pace with her on my side of the street, I wanted to invite her to the party. The hosts knew her from way back. But the sidewalks on both sides were crowded. When I did get across 6th, she was gone. Aftermath. That night, I came home from the party and found the place completely cleaned up, with a thank you note on the fridge, signed by all 3 kids. And I felt relieved, but also lost. The survivor party was on the Lower East Side. On my way back, I had gone by the East Village, walked up to 10th Street between B and C. People were out and about, bars were doing business, but there was still almost no vehicle traffic, and the block was very quiet. The building where we 3 had lived in increasing squalor and tension 35 years before was refinished, gentrified. I stood across the street looking. Maybe I willed his appearance. Jeff was there, in the corner of my eye, his face dead white, staring up, unblinking, at the light in what had been our windows. I turned towards him, and he disappeared. I looked aside, and he was there again, so lost and alone, the arms of his jacket soaked in blood. And I remembered us sitting around with the syringes and all of us making a pledge in blood to stick together as long as we lived, to which Jeff added, and even after. And I remembered how I had looked at him staring at Mags and knew she was looking at me, 3 sides of a triangle. The next day, Sunday, I went down to Mag's building, wanting very badly to talk to her. I rang the bell again and again. There was no response. I rang Super's apartment. She was a neighborhood lady, a lesbian around my age. I asked her about Mag's. She disappeared. Last time anyone saw her was Sunday, 9-9. People in the building checked to make sure everyone was okay. No sign of her. I put a tape across her keyhole Wednesday. It's still there. I saw her just yesterday. Yeah? She looked skeptical. Well, there's a World Trade Center list of potentially missing persons, and her name's on it. You need to talk to them. This sounded to me like the landlord trying to get rid of her. For the next week, I called Mags a couple of times a day. At some point, the answering machine stopped coming on. I checked her building regularly. No sign of her. I asked Angelina if she remembered the 2 of us having dinner at her place on Wednesday 9-12. I was too busy staying busy so I wouldn't scream. I remember you, and I guess you were with somebody. But no, honey, I don't remember. Then I asked Marco if he remembered the phone call, and he did, but was much too involved by then with Terry and Eloise to be really interested. Around that time, I saw the couple who had wanted to take their kids down to Ground Zero. They were walking up 6th Avenue, the kids cranky and tired, the parents looking disappointed, like the amusement park turned out to be a ripoff. Life closed in around me. A short story collection of mine was being published at that very inopportune moment, and I needed to do some publicity work. I began seeing an old lover who'd come back to New York as a consultant for a company that had lost its offices and a big chunk of its staff when the North Tower fell. Mrs. Pirelli did not come home from the hospital, but went to live with her son in Connecticut. I made it a point to go by each of the Arab shops and listen to the owners say how awful they felt about what had happened and smile when they showed me pictures of their kids in Yankee caps and shirts. It was the next weekend that I saw Mags again. The university had gotten permission for the students to go back to the downtown dorms and get their stuff out. Marco, Terry, and Eloise came by the library and asked me to go with them, so I volunteered. Around noon on Sunday, 9-23, a couple of dozen kids and I piled into a university bus driven by Roger, a Jamaican guy who has worked for the university for as long as I have. The day before 9-11, these kids didn't much want old farts keeping them company, Roger had said to me. Then they all wanted their daddy. He led a convoy of jitneys and vans down the FDR Drive, then through quiet Sunday streets, then past trucks and construction vehicles. We stopped at a police checkpoint. Cop looked inside and waved us through. At the dorm, another cop told the kids they had an hour to get what they could and get out. Be ready to leave at a moment's notice if I tell you to, he said. Roger and I, as the senior members, stayed with the vehicles. The air was filthy. Our eyes watered. A few hundred feet up the street, a cloud of smoke still hovered over the ruins of the World Trade Center. Piles of rubble smoldered. Between the pit and us was a line of fire trucks and police cars with cherry tops flashing. Behind us, the kids hurried out of the dorm carrying boxes. I made them write the names on the boxes and noted in which van the boxes got stowed. I was surprised, touched even, the number of stuffed animals that were being rescued. "Over the years, we've done some weird things to earn our pensions," I said to Roger. "Like volunteering to come to the gates of hell?" As he said that, flame sprouted from the rubble. Police and firefighters shouted and began to fall back. A fire department chemical tanker turned around, and the crew began unwinding hoses. Among the uniforms, I saw a civilian, a middle-aged woman in a sweater and jeans, carrying a sign. Mags walked toward the flames. I wanted to run to her. I wanted to shout, "Stop her!" Then I realized that none of the cops and firefighters seemed aware of her, even as she walked right past them. As she did, I saw another figure, thin, pale, in the suede jacket and bell-bottom pants. He held out his bloody hands, and together they walked through the smoke and flames into the hole in the city. "Was that them?" Marco had been standing beside me. I turned to him. Terry was back by the bus, watching Marco's every move. Eloise was gazing at Terry. "Be smarter than we were," I said. And Marco said, "Sure," with all the confidence in the world.
You have been listening to Richard Bowes reading his story, There's a Hole in the City, originally published in Sci Fiction Magazine in 2005, edited by Ellen Datlow. And this is obviously a very special story for us, and I hope one for you. And it is one of the things that demonstrates the ability and power of WBAI to bring you the kind of radio that you do not find elsewhere. You do not find writers reading their own work. You do not find often fiction at all, especially not of this power. You can find it on podcasts, but for broadcast radio, not. And that has to do, of course, with the nature of listener-sponsored radio, and we're going to be talking about that. Ha ha, surprise. One of the important things here is the ability for WBAI to bring you a broadcast like this one. After all, you're not going to find a program dedicated to speculative fiction in too many places, nor will you find one that will take on writers like Richard Bowes reading his fiction for you on the air. And it's a very special thing that WBAI is able to offer you. And right now, we can offer you some more. We are, of course, listener-sponsored. That is what makes it possible for us to bring you this kind of programming, this kind of fiction, and all the other things that you hear on WBAI, some wonderful programming from That Which You Will Hear in a Little While with David Rothenberg, or from Max Schmid to our award-winning news, and on and on. But I, of course, am very, very proud of the fact that we have had this tradition of bringing you science fiction, speculative fiction, fantasy, call it what you will, since 1963, when Baird Searle started producing this stuff for WBAI. I came here in 1967 at 13 years old, largely because of that kind of programming. And I know that that programming kept me glued to the radio. And I hope that Hour of the Wolf has done a little bit of that for you. And I hope even more that the totality of WBAI has done that for you. And therefore, it is incumbent upon us to ask you for your support. Now, any pledge of $25 or more makes you a member of WBAI. That gives you the right to vote on the various elections that we hold for board members and things like that over the year. But this morning, we are offering a CD, not just of the reading that you just heard, but on the 10th anniversary, when we broadcast that story. We also had a gentleman by the name of Charles B. Strozier. Dr. Strozier is the author of Until the Fire Stopped Burning, 9/11 in New York City. And his book is about the kind of trauma that has reached people throughout various disasters. And of course, if you were paying good attention to Rick Bowe's story, There's a Hole in the City, you know that we were dealing with the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, with the sinking of the General Slocum, where so many souls were lost, and about the aftermath of how people tried to cope and deal with these things. There was a fascinating discussion, runs a little over half an hour, that details not only what is important about There's a Hole in the City, but how it has affected us all. And you can get a CD of both the recording that you just heard of Richard Bowes reading his short story, plus that discussion with Charles Strozier, which I must say, I think you would find it valuable. The most valuable thing is that you'll be supporting WBAI, listener-sponsored radio in New York City. And that is something that has kept many a body afloat through the years. 20 years ago, and the aftermath of September 11th, when we were able to come back on the air, it took about 2 weeks because we were all six blocks away. If during your listening to this, you go to the WBAI website, and the one I will specify is give2wbai.org. That's 2 as in the number 2, give2wbai.org, and donate $50. You will get a CD, both with the reading you just heard and with that interview or discussion, I should say, with Dr. Charles Strozier. So let me entreat upon you now to make that donation. Even if you're already a member of WBAI, this is a gift not only to the station and not only to yourself to assure the future security of the station and the programming, but you will get the CD with these two items on it. The other way to do that, aside from going to give2wbai.org, is go to your phone and dial area code 212-209-2950, make a pledge of $50, and ask for There's a Hole in the City CD. Area code 212-209-2950. Again, There's a Hole in the City CD, and you will be able to get that. But the most important thing is to keep this radio station alive. So make that pledge now. Call area code 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. Or set your browser for give2wbai.org.
Tomorrow.
Coming up next on WBAI, our good friend David Rothenberg.
Tell me a story about your time at WBAI so I can let people know that you, in fact, have returned from retirement.
I retired because I was tired, but I found retirement more tiring than coming to BAI. BAI can be exhausting. Trump's there, and you have to yak about it. And if you're sitting at home, you're just shouting to the walls. When you have a program at WBAI, you can alert them about Donald Trump.
That's David Rothenberg. Tune in to any Saturday mornings from 8 to 10.
This is a well-oiled promotion, please.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org, your independent, grassroots, listener-funded radio station. Tune in on Saturday, September 11th from 4 to 6 p.m. for a live listener forum. It features candidates for WBAI's local station board. If you're wondering what skills and contribution these candidates plan to bring to WBAI as board members, well, they'll have some answers for you, and you'll have a chance to ask the candidates some questions of your own. Tune in to the live listener forum from 4 to 6 p.m. on Saturday, September 11th, right here on WBAI New York.
Greetings. Delegate elections are underway, and you are invited to leave a voicemail on 510-993-0320 with your questions and comments for candidates running to represent you on the local station board. We will invite all candidates to respond to your questions and produce an on-air election forum. Visit elections.pacifica.org for more information about the delegate election process, and remember to vote before 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on October 15th.
Batter up! Tune in to WBAI Playhouse Saturday evening at 8 p.m. for Bang the Drum Slowly, a story of a baseball player's loyalty as his friend faces a deadly disease.
So you're driving along with a man told he's dying, and yet everything is going on. The gas gauge is getting lower, the speedometer registering, cows nibbling in the field. And then you keep getting hungry, and you keep getting tired, and then you eat, and you sleep, and everything else begins all over again. You can't go on staggering from the first blow of it. You take it full, but you come back in.
How can you be in a joking mood?
Now, Bruce, he's cheering me up.
Where is he?
Well, right now, he's playing a pinball machine.
How unfair life is.
Bang the Drum Slowly, adapted by Eric Simonson from one of the best baseball novels by Mark Harris. The production stars Ed Begley Jr., David Schwimmer, Harry Shearer, and Jonathan Silverman.
Talking money is one thing, but talking business is another, and I will as soon trade the whole club for a tin of beans as leave anybody tell me who stays and who gets cut loose.
I am sorry to hear it, because without the clause, there will be no contract.
That's 8 p.m. on Saturday evening here on WBAI New York.
Of hell go ting-a-ling-a-ling for you, but not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory?
McDonough John and McCourt Malachy are on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, on Sundays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Topics, wit, wisdom, wackery, sausages. Join us, please!
But not for me. Oh, death, where is thy sting-a-ling-a-ling, or grave thy victory?
Hard work is how we support ourselves and our families. The jobs we do are a big part of who we are, and our jobs keep America going. Yet, the job site is where we have the least power. Many of us voiceless as corporations gamble away our health and our family's future just to feed their greed. It's time for the working class majority, for you and me, to regain our voices, to turn up the volume, assert our collective power, and to organize. Join me, Rick Smith, every Saturday night from 6 to 8 p.m. right here on WBAI 99.5 New York as we bring the class war and fight for a better future. The Rick Smith Show, every Saturday night, 6 to 8 p.m., right here on WBAI 99.5, New York's listener-supported radio. For more information, visit WBAI.org.
The time now is just about exactly 8 o'clock, and you're listening to WBAI New York.
You've got to start off each day with a song.
Sing it, Jimmy boy.
Not even when things go wrong.
Sing it for the heart.
Why, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand.
Give me five, Jimmy boy.
Well, tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You start off each day with a song.
Hit it!
Hey. You've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Now even when things go wrong.
Jimmy, you're a wild.
Why, you feel better. Let me hear those violins.
Let's hear the violins.
Music does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Only the other day I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it.
A million of them.
Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
You have to start off each day with a song. You gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh, with a song.
Now even when things go wrong. Mr. Crosby, I can do without that echo. But bingo, I'm in great voice tonight. It reminds me of the last recital I gave at Carnegie Hall.
Yeah?
It was delightful chamber music, and they came from miles around.
Who came?
Chambermaids. Who else? Let me hear that band. Hit it. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
No, that's...
Why, if you start off each day with a song.
And James Hersey at the helm finds a new version of, not new, new for us, of Durante singing, You Gotta Start Off Each Day With a Song. Jimmy was part of a trio in vaudeville called Durante Jackson, Clayton, and Durante. I think that was Eddie Jackson with him. Nice to hear a variation on it. Also nice to hear those spots. Bang the drum slowly tonight on BAI at 8 o'clock. I know what I'm going to do. I'll put on the Yankee-Met game, turn off the sound, watch, and listen. Bang the drum slowly, the best baseball book and baseball movie that I ever saw. The movie was with De Niro as a catcher. Michael Moriarty was a pitcher. My friend Tom Ligon was in on the team. I have to call him and let him know it's on the air tonight. And it's a moving, poignant story. De Niro, the catcher, is making a lot of boo-boos behind the plate. And as I recall, it's been a long time since I saw it and read it. Moriarty, his pitching partner and buddy, realizes that and discovers that his catcher is dying. And it's about two heroic efforts to keep playing the game against all odds, as I recall it. Good cast in it tonight. Bang the drum slowly on BAI at 8 o'clock tonight. I heard the promo with me, with Linda Perry. We need a new one. That one is passe. It's 9/11. Everyone is asking, do you remember where you were at 9/11? I wish I could forget. I stood on the corner at 16th and 6th, and I watched the buildings fall. And then the sound, a couple of minutes later, the roar was unbearable. I was standing there, and the image I remember is a hard hat, a construction worker standing on the lamp pole high above all of us, and covered his face and hid his tears. The combination and seeing the dust rising and this big, tough guy. It was for all of us. It was, I do remember, and no, I don't want to. This program will not be about 9/11 if you insist on recalling it every other station, every television program, every story today.
will be about 9/11. The essence of it, what came out of it, should be absorbed, understood, clarified, fought against. I don't need it to I don't need it to remind me of that image. I remember that night thinking, I wish it was 6 months from now, so all of this would be just a memory. And it's remained a memory. Actually, I'll be talking today about another part of another September event that has haunted my life, the Attica Uprising, the slaughter of nearly 40 American men by the state of New York. In the second hour, we'll be talking with Josh Melville, whose book American Time Bomb comes out this week, the son of Sam Melville, who was killed in the yard 50 years ago this week. If I were a book editor at the New York Times, that would be my cover book this Sunday. It's not, and it probably won't. I don't even know if it'll be reviewed. It should be on the bookshelves along with next on the other end of Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer, because this is about a boy's search for his father. We'll be talking with Josh after 9 o'clock. And what else happens? Well, it's about pandemic. It's about Texas. The prevailing ignorance seems to be meshing on all levels. The anti-vaccination people, a combination of Trumpies and just anti-vax people, chilling in their now they're becoming militant in their opposition to the vaccination. It's no longer my body, my choice. It's also becoming we don't want you to get it either. And that's a big difference. The demonizing of Fauci, the fact that 1 out of 4 cases in the South where the vaccination rates are low, that 1 out of 4 children. But the anti-vax began as I don't want it. I don't want to get it. Now it's we don't want you to get it either. And obviously they don't believe that my body is my temple. They think my body is their temple. And the emails keep coming. And then down in Texas, Governor Abbott, he and his partner Costello, with the governor of Florida, Abbott and Costello, they wearing a mask is an affront to their manhood. And with their manhood, Abbott, in the signing of the anti-abortion bill, started talking about women's bodies. AOC gave a response that was poignant and powerful, and telling him he doesn't know anything about menstruation. He doesn't know men don't know about menstruation. I don't know what a woman goes through. I don't know that if they miss a period, that it means that they're pregnant. It means that they missed a period. She was explaining that to us. He was also talking about going after all rapists. He would probably empty out his legislative body if he did that. Rape is you can start with Donald Trump if you're going after all rapists, right? Allegedly. We get sentimental about the good old days, and the good old days is when we had total segregation and slavery and then segregation, and everybody was in the closet. It was based on race, religion, and sexual orientation. The good old days weren't the good old days, but they didn't have the internet spreading the myths and the lies and the misinformation. Sometimes I wish I could go back, because while the old days were not innocent, I was, because I didn't know all those things. I think when people talk about going back to the good old days, they want to go back to the childhood when they were ill-informed. The problem is so many of them grow up and stay ill-informed. Thus, we have the anti-science movement against vaccinations, for example. Well, he is going on. Let's have some music. This is probably the last week of the year that we can play this song, James Irsay. And thank you for being with us this morning.
My pleasure, David. My pleasure always.
And what time do you go on Sundays? Is it 8?
It's 8.
That's when I tuned in last week. And
there I was.
And there you were. and you're back again.
That's right.
You're ubiquitous. All right. This song by Michael Bublé sings, and it's Johnny Mercer wrote the lyrics. I love Johnny Mercer. I've told the story 100 times about the day I spent with him. My friend Gene Bach had 2 guests for the weekend in the country, me and Johnny Mercer, sitting in the backyard listening to him regale about all the songs. He didn't talk about this one, but Michael Bublé is about to sing it. It's the last week of the year that we could play it. So take it away, Michael Bublé.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea. It lingered there, touch your hair and walk with me. All summer long we sang a song, then we strolled that golden sand. Two sweethearts and the summer wind. Those days and nights went flying by. The world was new beneath the blue umbrella sky. Then softer than a piper man, one day it called to you. I lost you to the summer wind. Still the days, those lonely days go on and on. But guess who sighs his lullabies through nights that never end? My fickle friend, the summer wind. Friend, the summer wind.